Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This episode of The Commons is sponsored by New College Franklin. At New College Franklin, students and professors together find their place in an educational tradition that stretches back for ages, returning to tried and true educational practices and texts that have been discarded for too long. Through a robust exploration of the great books and the classical seven liberal arts in an environment of rich conversation, shared life, and spiritual discipleship, New College students see how they fit in the unfolding story of redemption. Take the next step in your education and join the conversation in beautiful Franklin, Tennessee. Come for a preview weekend or schedule a visit at your convenience and continue building on the educational foundation you've started. You can learn more at www.newcollegefranklin.org. That's newcollegefranklin.org. And now, The Commons with Brian Phillips.
Well, hello again. Welcome back to The Commons. I'm your host, Brian Phillips. We are continuing season two here on The Commons, our conversations about important figures and movements in church history. And here in episode three, I'm joined by a familiar guest, familiar voice to all of you, Wes Callahan. Wes Callahan is one of the main teachers for Roman Roads Media Old Western Culture Series. He's also the founder of Scola Classical Tutorials and Hill Abbey, a frequent guest at Circe conferences, a wonderful speaker. And today he's joining me for a conversation not about one early church father, but about three who were commonly grouped together, known as the Cappadocian Fathers. So we're going to be discussing those three important church fathers, wonderful theologians, all of whom played an important role in the formation of Orthodox Trinitarian theology, as well as being wonderful pastors, writers, and thinkers. And so hope you enjoy this episode. Thanks for tuning in with us. And now here begins my conversation about the Cappadocian Fathers with Wes Callahan. Well, Wes Callahan, welcome back. Hasn't been too long this time.
Well, thank you, Brian. No, it hasn't. Thanks for having me back. I enjoy doing this with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we've done the first episode on St. John Chrysostom. Then I was joined by Greg Wilbur last time talking about St. Ambrose. And now, roughly in that same time period, 4th century, we're going to talk today about the Cappadocian Fathers. Looking forward to this. Each of these men were influential, very significant in their own right. But I want to start out by just discussing why it is that these three men, St. Basil the Great, St. Gregory of Nyssa, and St. Gregory of Nazianzus, are referred to together. Why are they referred to sort of as a so closely linked as the Cappadocian Fathers?
Yeah, partly because they were connected in a relationship, Two of them were brothers. Basil and Gregory of Nyssa were brothers, and Gregory Nazianzus was their great friend. And they're all from the region of Cappadocia, which is central modern day Turkey, was a real center because of their efforts, became a real center of Christianity. But they're all from the same region, have a lot of early formation together. They go to the University of Athens together, at least Basil and Nazianzus do, primarily because these three together kind of continue the work done by Athanasius in Christian definitions, in Orthodox definitions of God. So Athanasius works, of course, on Christology, you know, back in the Council of Nicaea, and then in his combat with the Arians for the next 50 years, during part of the early life of the Cappadocians. Athanasius is dealing with Christology and the nature of Christ against the Arians. The full deity of Christ. The Arian or the Cappadocians pick up on the work of Athanasius and they push it further, developing a Trinitarian theology in general. So it's due to them that we have a real clear and accurate and powerful development of the discussion of the three persons in one essence and so on, God in three persons, the Trinitarian theology that becomes fully developed under them. That's the primary reason they're called Cappadocians, because the reason they're lumped together because they're friends, they're working together on in the ministry, and primarily remembered because of their work in Trinitarian theology specifically.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is interesting, and I want to try to draw together what we've talked about in this season on this podcast so far, because in the first episode when we talked about St. John Chrysostom, he's not only remembered for being a great preacher, a great orator, but also a great pastor and contributing to the development of liturgy, that influence has continued to this day. And then, of course, I talked with Greg Wilbur about St. Ambrose, and so you had, incredibly skilled, talented bishop, but contributed so much to the music and singing of the early church. And now with the Cappadocians, we have these three great theologians, pastors, friends who contributed a great deal to the development of our theology. And so it's great to see these different strands, you know, all around the same time period, really being brought together and still feeling that influence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk a bit about them individually, because as I mentioned, these men were giants in their own right. And when you think about the work that they did together, it's really really inspiring. But let's talk about Saint Basil the Great or Basil of Caesarea. One of the purposes of this podcast is to give people just kind of an introduction, a kind of a doorway into the lives of these great men. So let's talk about how he became such an influential church father. So tell us about St. Basil and his influence.
And by the way, your earlier comments about the, you know, the power of this age. I mean, this, in some ways, this is, you know, some people describe this as kind of the golden age of early Christianity because there's so many powerhouses of the faith: Athanasius, Augustine, the Cappadocians, Ambrose, Saint Jerome, John Chrysostom, the Desert Fathers. They're just, you know, you can't turn around without stumbling over, you know, some powerful figure.
Yeah,
it's really really an amazing age, and the beginning of the age of the councils.
Right, and you're highlighting for the listeners all the people that I'm going to miss in my list of it's very hard to narrow down to 9 or 10 episodes who to cover. So thanks for drawing attention to that, Wes.
oh, my pleasure. Anytime I can help.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And Basil is obviously one of these guys. He and his younger brother, Gregory, known as Gregory of Nyssa, they come from a family that has a long Christian heritage. Parents and grandparents who are faithful Christians, and the women in the family, mothers and grandmothers and sisters, also have been named saints by the Catholic Church, and deservedly so. just a powerful Christian family, well-educated, lots of people in the family well-educated in rhetoric and literature in general. And they're active in many members of the family, his ancestors active in civil life and so on. So they would have been not as famous in history, but they would have been probably showing up in the history books anyway, or at least the records of the times in that area, just for their involvement in civic life and the leadership they took in Cappadocia. But Basil, if I'm always afraid I've wandered off the off the question. I think your question was, how did he become who he was? Is that right?
Well, I'm sort of left it open ended for you to why was Basil so influential?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, there's a number of amazing things. One of them is just his work, his writings in theology, which, along with Gregory Nazianzus and Gregory of Nyssa, as we said earlier, influences the direction that Christian theology would take in terms of describing the Trinity. Another is his influence on monasticism. The rule of Saint Basil, which he promulgated and is still followed in Eastern Christianity, had a tremendous influence in the Eastern Mediterranean monasticism, like Saint Benedict's rule did in Western monasticism, very much in the same order. So in his theological writings, in his monastic writings, and then in local practical charity, Basil is known for taking the leadership in his region of the world in founding orphanages and hospitals and the equivalent of soup kitchens, and his work on behalf of the poor and the marginalized in a society that up to that day paid no attention to them. One of the great radicalisms of Christianity was starting to take care of people that in the old pagan Roman world were simply shoved out and abandoned. And Christianity elevates the status, of women and foreigners and of slaves, but also of the poor and the sick. And it's in this age, under the influence of Basil and also John Chrysostom and the others, but especially Basil is known for this, that we have the beginning of social institutions designed to take care of people that Roman paganism would simply abandon. There was nothing like hospitals in ancient Roman times. There were doctors. But social institutions funded by the government or by private contributions, designed to house and take care of and show love to, civic and social love to people, is a new thing, and Basil really takes the lead in that. And so, in terms of Christian social work and charity, he's well known. I might mention, in terms of his theology, one of the books is very influential and still is in print and available is a short little book called On the Holy Spirit, which is a brilliant exposition of the theology of the Holy Spirit, and also an example of the way he theologizes, the way he handles Scripture, and it shows why he, why he was such a great preacher. He was also known for his oratory. Basil was well trained in oratory, as was Gregory Nazianzus, and Basil, in his own day, and for a long time afterwards, I guess still, was known for his oratory, and so not just not just for the theology, for the content of his writings, as you remembered, but for the brilliance of his speaking style.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting to me that as we've been talking about the early church fathers and the different bishops that we have discussed so far, it's very difficult to pin any of them down to, they were not men of a single skill. They're very talented men, very skilled, gifted men. If you had to, this is doing him a great injustice, kind of like I asked you to do with St. John Chrysostom, and then I asked Greg Wilbur to do with St. Ambrose, but if you had to highlight the most lasting contribution of St. Basil the Great, what do you think that would be?
That is terrible.
Who's your favorite child, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that is really hard. I think what most people would say, and I, I'm happy to go along with this. It's his theology, his contributions to theology. That's the way most people would answer, and rightly so. I think because I've spent a lot of time studying and teaching to my students the influence of and the tremendous importance, the kind of the under the radar importance in Western culture, especially in the Middle Ages, of monasticism. I'm drawn to thinking of his influence there. And there he's less known in the West, more in the East. But I'm looking for parallel movements. You know, the West and the East are not divided. It's one church, and we see Benedict founding this movement called monasticism, which will be critically important in the survival not just of the church but of culture in the West.
Right.
And Basil's rule in the East and the monasticism that flows from him is kind of paralleling. In fact, there's a lot of cross pollination between the two as well. So I guess. That's one of those questions you have to answer by saying, well, what are we talking about? We're talking about, intellectual labors, then it's his theology. What about his practical labors, then it's monasticism?
Right.
Terrible question, Brian.
Yeah,
terrible
I was going to say it's best just not to ask. So continuing to talk about them individually, St. Gregory of Nyssa, they all having friendship and work together. They obviously all lived in the same time period. So let's talk about him. I think Gregory of Nyssa, perhaps a little less known to our listeners, I'm assuming there, than Basil the Great was. So talk to us about him and his influence in the early church.
He's probably is a little bit less known than the others. Although in circles that would really know these guys, he's not considered as less important. He takes a subordinate position, probably partly because in both the Western Eastern Church, we think of the Cappadocian fathers. In the Eastern Church, in particular, they have another category they call the three holy hierarchs. And those are Basil the Great, Gregory Nazianzus, and John Chrysostom. So Gregory of Nyssa gets left out.
Right.
And they think of those three, for various theological reasons. But so you have these groups: the Cappadocian Fathers, the Holy Hierarchs, and Gregory of Nyssa doesn't really get to fit in any of them. And yet he deserves a lot of attention. He's only a couple of years younger than his brother Basil, two or three years younger than Nazianzus, I guess. Not as influential in terms of his social activity. He has a reputation as not being as administratively talented as Basil certainly was. He has a reputation, I think more or less deserved, of being less perhaps systematically theological as Gregory Nazianzus was. He has a reputation for being more mystical. I'm not sure that I think that can be overemphasized, but this mystical element comes partly because Gregory, and maybe this is one of the reasons why people know him a little bit less. There might be some reluctance on the part of some people because Gregory of Nyssa is very influenced by Origen and Origen's Neoplatonism. Origen has never been called by any branch of the church Saint Origen. He's never been considered a church father because of the danger of some of his writings, what later were considered heresy, his subordinationism, his universalism, some other things. But Origen's always been deeply, deeply respected, so he's called a theologian, great church writer, but never a father or a saint. But Gregory of Nyssa is. He's considered a church father, and he is considered a saint by those branches of the church that canonize or glorify people, even though he seems to verge in the direction of kind of sympathy with Origen, even to the extent in some of Gregory of Nyssa's writings that look like a friendliness to universalism, Origen-style universalism. He never outright commits himself to it, but he writes sympathetically, and that might make some people nervous. But the church is no branch of the church has ever said he's heretical. You can't call him a father. He's not a saint. But they all accept him as one of them. He writes his really great stuff. Some of his best stuff is things like his book On the Soul and the Resurrection, just tremendous exploration of it. But when he does, he writes in a way that's not kind of like, systematic or scholastic. It's thoroughly biblical. It's very well reasoned. But he reasons in this in a way that I guess you can only describe as more you know, more mystical than surely rational. I think it's even misrepresenting for me to put it that way, but that's the best way I can think of it. He's more poetic, although Gregory Nazianzus wrote some great poetry and hymns and so on. Nyssa was certainly a poetic mind and writer.
Now, some writers that I've run across have I wouldn't say charged, but maybe at least hinted that Gregory of Nyssa is a difficult theologian to pin down. A bit ambiguous at times. And I think maybe you hinted at what you're getting at, where he seems sympathetic with Origen, or at least hinting at universalism. Do you think that those claims are fair? What would be your response to that?
You know, I don't know. I'm not a good enough student of Gregory to be able to answer that question well. I think what I would say I would answer this. I would say, no, I don't think it's fair to charge him with universalism. I don't think that he held that, because the church, the church in the first millennium, the undivided church, spoke out against universalism, but they don't speak out against Gregory. And there's I'm not a completely thorough student of the first millennium, but I know enough about it to know that the church never condemned any of Gregory's writings the way they condemned some of Origen's writings.
Right.
So just on that score, I would say I don't think it would be fair to condemn him or to charge him with universalism, because if he were truly guilty of that, I think that we would have seen voices of the church, making noise about it.
Right.
So that's my tentative response. What I have read of him, I saw nothing that smacked of universalism, but I haven't read everything of Nyssa's.
Yeah. Well, and that makes sense. I mean, it's not as if the church was shy about coming to conclusions on those matters.
yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah.
So if ambiguous, perhaps, but certainly not worthy of his writings or being rejected.
I think the ambiguity probably comes from our inability to understand. It's not ambiguous in that he's trying to say something and pussyfooting around it and hinting at something he believes, but doesn't want to come right out and say. It's not that kind of ambiguity.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And of course, given the topics of his writings, it's not as if we should be surprised by inability to understand times. Right.
Right. Some of the modern people who have acted like universalists, modern writers who appeal to Gregory, they have different ways of doing it. But some of them better, some of them worse. In general, when they appeal to Origen and try to appeal to Nyssa as universalists, they are pointing out the things where Origen and Nyssa are arguing from laudable, presumptions. Origen, for example, although he's condemned by the church as a universalist, the church says, in a number of the councils and so on later on, that universalism cannot be held legitimately by a Christian. Origen, at least, you have to give him credit. He's not saying we must believe that everyone must be saved, because it would just be so sad if anyone were lost. Origen argues from a thoroughgoing belief in the power of the gospel. He says, how can it be imagined that anything would fall or could stand before the power of the gospel? So that seems like an admirable motive, though he derived the wrong conclusion from it.
Right.
And I think Gregory tends to do the same thing. He has this deep understanding of the infinite and utterly unbounded love and compassion of God, and he argues from that presupposition, not from a sentimentalist, I can't imagine grandma being in hell kind of thing.
Right. Right. And that is, even rejecting the conclusion, it is at least certainly a better starting point, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Certainly something to be said for that.
Now,
last but not least, of the three Cappadocian fathers, let's discuss St. Gregory of Nazianzus. He too was a bishop, a very influential theologian. So what should we remember about him?
Right. Gregory Nazianzus, he might be the most profound of the theologians of the three. In fact, he's one of the few people that gets the title theologian in history. At least the Eastern Church has They call John the beloved disciple. John, they call him John the theologian, the author of the fourth gospel. John the theologian. They call Gregory the theologian. And then there's a guy around the year 1000 at the end of the millennium called Saint Simeon the new theologian. Those are the only three people the Eastern Church give the name of theologians. That tells you how highly the East views him, and the West as well. Though they don't use that kind of, they're not using those titles. So there again, there's that kind of three lumping. Nazianzus is the guy that John of Damascus, who about three and a half centuries later, to whom John of Damascus refers most in his great work, his systematic theology. John of Damascus wrote a book called The Fount of Knowledge, which is comprised of a philosophical treatise and then a section on heresies, and then a section called On the Orthodox Faith, which is a review of what the church has always believed up to his time, an attempt not to be novel and original, but to summarize what Orthodox, Catholic, Universal, non-heretical Christianity has taught. And John of Damascus draws more heavily on Gregory Nazianzus than anybody. And that book, John of Damascus's book, is hugely important in both East and West in the centuries following. And so so indirectly, Gregory Nazianzus is, right? I mean, it's kind of like pointing out that Thomas Aquinas and Luther and Calvin are all great medieval or Reformation theologians, but they're all heavily dependent on Augustine. So Augustine is influential indirectly through all those guys. And so you could say the same thing about Nazianzus through John of Damascus and others. I think people probably appeal more to Gregory Nazianzus and his theology than they do to the theology of Nyssa and Basil. So of the three Cappadocians, I think it would be safe to say he's the most profound theologian and the most highly respected. Mm-hmm. Not that the others are anything to sneeze at, but he's the big gun.
Right. Now, one of the things that stands out in considering these three men, along with St. Ambrose, with St. John Chrysostom, that I find truly inspiring from my perspective, is that they are sort of supreme pastor theologians. And those, perhaps this is a modern problem, but those are almost titles that we distinguish now. We think of the work of a pastor and the work of a theologian as being very different, and yet these men all seem to bring that together in a beautiful way. I mean, not just in occupying the office of pastor or performing the duties of a theologian or a pastor, but they contributed in both worlds. So they're this kind of perfect blending of the office. Had their concern for the poor, concern for their people, but then also great defenders of the truth as well.
Yeah, yeah. And it might be. I think that's very true. And that, in fact, that's characteristic, probably in general, of many of the great men of this age that you're talking about in your series and so on. Every one of them, of none of them, can it be said that he was a great theologian, but he wasn't a very good pastor, right? Or great pastor, but had no ideas worth talking about. But right. Also, it probably is the case. I mean that. We're more susceptible in our in modern times to make not just a distinction but a separation between pastoral ability and theological ability, and for them it's all of a piece.
Right.
And so you see, like a Gregory Nazianzus, for example, he actually was appointed to lead the Second Ecumenical Council, the Council of Constantinople in 381, and that shows the ability, not only the ability that people attributed to him in administration, that he could lead a council that's concerned with theological things, but their trust in him as a pastor, because the councils were always seen as pastoral councils. They're not just settling things to be written down in theological tomes, but they're settling things that preachers have to preach and that pastors have to give out in their homilies in order to lead people to God. You can't lead people to God through Christ without knowing who God is, who Christ is, and why Christ is the way, without knowing the gospel. And the councils are always fundamentally about protecting the gospel. A heresy arises, the council meets, has to deal with it, and that's a pastoral concern. And like other leaders of the councils and all the other men at the councils, all the bishops who make them up, Gregory Nazianzus is called to lead the council, to, you know, to chair it, you might say, because they acknowledge his not just his intellectual but his pastoral ability. And I think that's probably what he loved even more than, you know, than what we think of as the sheerly intellectual side of theology, because he retires from the council. He's tired from the struggle and political strife, though it's important, because he's not just because he's getting older and feels that his resources waning, but because he loves the contemplation of Christ that he hopes everyone will experience and he wants to experience. And you can see that in all of these. You can see underneath everything this deep love of Jesus Christ, which makes them the men that they were.
Now, these three men were, as you said, particularly important at the councils, in even the formulation of the Nicene Creed, Trinitarian theology. Can you give us sort of an overview for our listeners of what their contributions were and why it was so important, both during their time historically and then subsequently in church history too? I know that's a tall order, but just sort of a Reader's Digest version of why those issues and councils were so important and the role these men played.
that is a tall order. But the terms that we tend to most to use now, like homoousios, which is given to us by the First Council, and especially Athanasius, who argues the value of this term, and then terms like hypostases, which the Cappadocians are known for giving us. These terms that we use most frequently now, we do because we think they're the best. They're the best way of expressing. Not that they're the only way, but they're the best way of expressing, in contrast to error, you know, what we must say about God and about God revealed in Jesus Christ. So they've contributed that to us. They've contributed to us a way of talking in terms of person, three persons. When we say three persons, one God in three persons, and even the great hymn, Holy, 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 where we say that. Mm-hmm. God in three persons, blessed Trinity. That's an inheritance of the Cappadocians. It's an inheritance generally of Christianity, but the Cappadocians are the three who in God's providence contributed this way of talking in order to protect us from error, just like it's the whole church that contributed to us the understanding of Christology. But Athanasius, in God's providence, was the means for giving us homoousios, the same substance. And like Athanasius, the Cappadocians have given us the idea that you can borrow where you must the things, the terms, the categories that you need as tools. And so, like homoousios, the term hypostasis is something brought out of earlier pre-Christian pagan philosophy and turned to Christian use. So another thing they've contributed to us is that. Is the idea that in doing theology, which is for them, and sometimes they'll say this, doing theology, which is a kind of prayer, in doing theology before the face of God, we can draw from every place where God has given truth, and that includes the pagans. So the pagans, in various ways and for various reasons, develop certain terms like logos, or homoousios, or hypostases, which didn't mean originally what they came to mean in Christian hands, but they were legitimately turned to Christian purposes, because in the Hellenistic culture of the early church, people knew enough about these terms that they said, this is valuable, we can use this. And it was often the heretics who would say things like, you can't use that, that's not in the Bible. That's Arius's argument against Athanasius, and Athanasius suggests homoousios. That's not biblical language. But Athanasius says it doesn't matter. It's a biblical concept expressed in a term that we need to use to clarify things now. Mm-hmm. And the Cappadocians have given that kind of theologizing to us. They give us the doctrine of the Trinity being one essence, one ousios, and three persons, three hypostases, united in a single Godhead. And so when we talk about the consubstantiality of the persons of the Trinity, that we got from the Cappadocians. All this language, this Trinitarian language, comes from them. You don't see this kind of language earlier. You see these doctrines earlier, but they're you might say, fuzzier because the need hasn't arisen for clarification. So now we're clearer on the doctrine of the Trinity because of these expressions of the Cappadocians.
Mm-hmm. Now, go ahead.
We might throw in one thing as well. It wasn't just the education of these men. They had a great education. It wasn't just the education of them, of these guys, that made them what they were. And I hope I didn't give that impression to our listeners by what I said earlier. Because one of the friends of Basil and Gregory who went to the University of Athens with them was a guy named Julian, who later became an emperor known as Julian the Apostate. When Julian, as a young man, went to the university with Basil and Gregory and was one of their buddies, hung out with them, he claimed to be a Christian, later abandoned that Christianity and reverted to paganism and tried to turn the Roman world pagan again after Constantine and his descendants had begun to emphasize Christianity. So I didn't mean to suggest earlier that this kind of education is the thing that's responsible for their godliness and their faithfulness and their greatness, because Julian had the same kind of education.
Right.
He didn't have the same kind of family, and he clearly, for whatever other reasons, didn't have the same kind of heart. But he had the same education, so it's not just education alone, that makes them.
Right. Well, and on behalf of most of us nowadays, I'm glad that it's not solely our education that makes us. I appreciate you being willing to take on that very big question. I mean, that's a tough one to answer, but I think it's important. I at least wanted us to hit on that a bit, because one of the things that can be very easy for us to do is to forget that the theological heritage that we have, for example, as handed down to us in the creeds, was hard won. And I think it can be easy to forget that because we're not necessarily embroiled, at least that we pay attention to, we're not embroiled in those same controversies. I don't think that those old heresies have necessarily gone away. Sometimes they're just repackaged and represented, but
right. And we can be subject to the same heresies and their new forms if we don't know our church history, if we don't study these guys and see what they did, and the hard work, as you suggested, that they did. When we talk about this as a golden age, it doesn't mean it was an easy age. This was an age of ferocious battle, on behalf of the truth. When other people are saying no, it's this. I mean, when Arius and these other Apollinarians, the subordinationists, and all the other heresies that the church is struggling against. We're presenting plausible cases, and Christians right and left were following him. So this was an age of ferocious battles, very hard work.
Right.
And it would be a terrible pity if we didn't honor that and all that work was for nothing. It's not, but we want to participate in preserving the knowledge of the work they did, so we don't wind up reinventing the wheel, which we're always in danger of doing if we're ignorant of history.
Right, and we want to give honor where honor is due. And not forget their contributions. In closing here, if our listeners wanted to learn more about these men, explore a bit more, where would you recommend that they start? Do you have any favorite books or resources for learning more about the Cappadocian Fathers, whether collectively or even the time period or the men individually?
Yeah, there's some good information about them, of course, on the internet, and it's been a while, but the last time I looked at the Wikipedia article, it did a good job. I think that what I mentioned in our discussion about St. John Chrysostom is kind of the same thing here. Some of the good general church histories are a good way to start because it places them in their context. Bruce Shelley's Church History, Philip Schaff's History of the Christian Church. Some of those, and there's a number of good ones out there. Most of the ones I've run across have been decent. Those are simply ones I've used. But a good general church history is a good way to start, because then you get them in the chronological flow. You see what came before them, what came after them. You get them in context, and then you could read more about them. There are a number of books who share the same title, The Cappadocian Fathers. I haven't looked at many of them, but there's one is probably the first hit you get on Amazon if you looked it up, and that looked like a decent one. But I think maybe the next thing to do after reading about them in the general histories, which is the place to start, would be to read some of their own works. Basil the Great's book on the Holy Spirit, still in print, is an excellent short work. Profoundly, biblical and full of theological sweetness, and recognized on all hands as a tremendous work. That's a good way to be introduced to it. Gregory Nazianzus wrote not only a theology, which is a little tougher to get into, but still well worth reading. But he wrote an oratory on the death of Basil, because Basil died earlier, and Gregory of Nazianzus, his friend, wrote an oration on the death of his friend that's well worth reading, and it shows the brilliance and the oratorical skill as well as the biblical learning that they bring to bear. Mm. That's worth reading. Gregory of Nyssa, his book on the soul and the resurrection is tremendous, especially for his defense of a doctrine that's being abandoned even by so-called Bible-believing Christians in the modern age. And I can't remember what the statistics were on the last studies I read were, survey of so-called conservative, church-going, Bible-believing Christians in America who doubt the physical resurrection. Mm. That's just mind-boggling, because that's one of those non-negotiable essential doctrines of the faith as established by the church over the ages. Right. And so Nyssa's little work on the soul and the resurrection is a brilliant exposition of that fundamental doctrine. So reading the works of these guys themselves is a good way to start. Basil's on the Holy Spirit, Nazianzus' oration on his friend on the death of his friend, and Nyssa's on the soul and the resurrection. Those are three that I'd recommend to start getting into their minds, and then just moving on from there. Philip Schaff's 38-volume Early Church History, the Early Church Fathers set. That's a massive set, but it's well worth having, and it's got a bunch of good representative stuff from all three of these guys. Mm-hmm.
And I think if the 38 volumes seems a little intimidating, you can buy them individually, I believe.
Yeah.
You just have to pick the right volumes.
Exactly.
Well, Wes, thank you so much for taking the time to discuss the Cappadocian Fathers with us. Inspiring, informative, as always. So thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me, Brian.
Well, thanks to all of you for joining us for this episode of The Commons. Thanks again to Wes Callahan for this wonderful conversation today. And until next time, I'm your host, Brian Phillips, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.